I was thinking a bit about the question that person posed last night, the person who is experiencing an illness, an autoimmune illness, disorder of some sort, and the trials, tribulations, difficulties that go along with that, and just, in general, reflecting on the body, nature, illness, those sorts of things. But, and also thinking it would be nice to also just follow up a little bit on some of Lung Pa's comments from this morning again. But I was thinking about the whole notion of autoimmune disease. I don't know if everybody's familiar with what that is, but I was thinking about that. And, I don't know huge amounts about it, but just essentially the little I know of it is it's when the body's immune system kind of goes a little bit haywire and starts producing substances that actually start to turn against some of the body's own healthy organs and tissues. It's sort of a misfiring, I guess, of the immune system in a way. And I think there's a lot they still don't know about it and why it happens and how it happens and even, how to really treat it. It's not so cut and dry as some other physical problems are. And so I was just thinking about, that really poses a unique set of challenges for the person who's dealing with that, because, our nature, when there's illness or difficulty, whether it's physical or mental issues, psychological issues, emotional issues, is we want to know, why is this happening? What's the cause of it? Because the hope and the feeling is that if we just know what's causing it, then we can treat it and take care of it and not have to deal with it and deal with the pain and the difficulty. But when something doesn't have a real clear-cut cause, or when the course of treatment isn't so clear, or say in the psychological or emotional realm, when what we try doesn't work, it's a cause for a lot of concern, a lot of difficulty, sometimes struggle, very much of a challenge. We like to have answers, and oftentimes they're not there. And also just with the autoimmune thing, that it's like, normally you think, well, the immune system is something that's my friend, and it's going to keep me from getting certain kinds of illnesses, help in the healing process of others, and it's turning against me. It's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. So that's an additional challenge in working with it. So I'm not quite sure if I remember it correctly, but it seems like the person who was expressing the question was also saying that, they had to spend a fair amount of time looking at the different symptoms and signs, manifestations of this, and to track them closely to create some sort of report of the ups and downs of various aspects of it to help with the treatment regimen. And I'm not sure if this is what they were saying, but possibly there's a lot of time and energy and focus and attention that needs to be put on really paying attention to some of these things, and that's a challenge as well. You have to focus so much time and energy on that. I would suspect, anyway, that it becomes a significant part of one's day and a significant part of one's life, and easy to become absorbed in having to track those kinds of things for the welfare of your own body. And at least if it were me, I think that I would probably find it a challenge as to how to hold that in perspective, how to keep a balance with it, and how to practice with it in a dharmic kind of a way. And when Paul was talking about reflections around that this morning as well. So there's a unique challenge there. And it, I think it can be extrapolated to many experiences in all of our lives when we're dealing with things that aren't the way we want them to be, physically, mentally, situationally. How do we deal with it in a way that's going to be useful and productive, and a way that we have to, because we have to deal with things in the conditioned realm. We can't just ignore things all the time, but yet keep a perspective on it so that we don't get lost in it, get involved, overly concerned with it. How can we keep a balanced perspective? One of the teachings that I find useful to reflect on is, in that light, are the teachings around karma, cause and effect. And you know, topics like karma and rebirth, sometimes I think in Western circles are, you know, not a real popular reflection. Some people, you know, feel that, well, you can't really prove some of these kinds of things, or it doesn't feel right, or there's various reasons why people don't take to, say, teachings on karma and rebirth very much. But I still find that, I mean, it's pretty much part and parcel of the Buddhist teachings as I understand them, and find them a very useful kind of reflection. And as is the case with all of the Buddhist teachings, you know, these kinds of teachings aren't meant to necessarily be a statement of doctrine or belief that one has to pick up and say, I believe in this, but more of a way of using it as a tool for reflection, investigation. It has a sort of a purposeful mode to it that one can pick up, so that one can say, well, you know, I'll pick this up for consideration and apply it and see what the results are in my own mind, see what the results are in my own heart. Make that a basis for how to use these teachings rather than picking them up as a belief or a statement of doctrine. So anyway, the teachings on karma, I think I find really useful when considering difficulties in life. And Ajahn Jeff has a real, I think, useful, I found it very insightful, way of talking about some of the basic structure of how cause and effect work in our lives. And he frames it within the context of the teaching, the Pali idipachayata, his translation, his use of the term this, that conditionality, sort of the general, more broad statement of his teachings around the Buddha's teachings around dependent origination. But the basic framework or statement of this, that conditionality is pretty simple, and it's a statement on, I think, you know, essentially the law of karma, the law of cause and effect. And for those of you who may not be familiar with that, it's just a very straightforward set of four phrases. And it goes something like, when this is, that is. And then the second is, with the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. And with the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. So that's it in its basic four simple phrase statement of conditionality, of how things come to arise and cease. And it's a, you know, just meant to be a description of how comic actions arise into the world and how they pass away. Comma being any kind of action of body, speech, or mind that has intention behind it. So there's other natural laws in the universe too. Everything is not just comma. There's natural laws of biology and natural sciences, different kinds of laws of nature that operate around us and are part of our lives. And the law of comma is one of them, and it's based on intention, the intention in the mind to perform some sort of action, whether it's by body, by speech, or mental activity. So there's always intention behind that. So in those four phrases of conditionality, need to realize that that's based on this factor of intention as well. But he, Ajahn Jeff, really teases it out a little in a, what I think is a real, very, very useful way when we're considering, well, how does comma work in my life and what does it mean? Because he takes those four phrases and divides them up into two subsets. And one he calls the linear aspect of comma, and the other one he calls the synchronic aspect of comma. And basically the first and the third are sort of the synchronic, and the second and fourth are what he calls the linear. So you have the first one of when this is, that is, and the third one of when this isn't, that isn't, to describe certain aspects of experience that are in existence, happen, in conjunction with others. And when those causes and conditions are absent, then the results are absent as well. So these play together in synchronicity. They come at the same time. When something is present, there's another thing that comes along with it. When something is absent, there's another thing that doesn't appear with it. And then the linear aspect, which is maybe something we're a little more familiar with in around the teachings of comma, is the linear aspect. When this comes to be, or when this arises, then that will come to be, or that arises. When this ceases, then will come the cessation of that. So that refers more to the over time. A seed for something to arise in the present moment, and it manifests later on into the future, or something that some intentional activity that happened in the past may have a result later on in the present or further into the future. And the same for the cessation aspect of it. So that refers more to the aspects or the workings of comma over time. So it's and then Ajahn Jeff describes that the importance of these two aspects is when we consider what's happening in our lives. Because any kind of intentional activity will have results. Whereas comma is action with intention behind it, the results that we experience from that are what's called vipaka. It helps to explain why we, you know, may experience certain things in the present moment. So that what we experience, comic-related, resultant related, at any one point in time, can be the result of, say, past actions. And if you have a long-term perspective, these can be not only from this lifetime, but from past lifetimes. So the arising of different conditions planes of rebirth, even human rebirth versus rebirth in other realms, how that manifests in our present situation, the conditions, the family, the situation, the culture, the time and place that we're born into, the different kinds of friendships and people that come into our lives, and, you know, to some extent, possibly the different mental states and physical states that we experience can be a result of past intentions. I hesitate to imply that that's, you know, a blanket statement, because there's a lot of laws of nature that are playing together at the same time, just by virtue of the fact that we have a human body. You know, the virtue of the fact that we have a human body is a result of causes and conditions too, but, you know, it could be that, you know, not every little thing that goes wrong with us is a result of some major karmic action from a past life. You know, we have to be careful not to take everything extremely literally, but that there are those kinds of trends. And to try and figure out and to try and know the exact causes and conditions that led to a particular state is something that the Buddha actually doesn't really advise us doing a whole lot of, trying to question or posit in our minds. You know, it's like, well, you know, I've got this particular illness or this particular difficulty. What did, quote unquote, what did I do wrong, you know, in a past life that is causing this? Or, you know, certain conditions that are positive. Likewise, that the workings of karma are so, so complex, immensely complex, that the human mind doesn't have the capacity to understand it. That trying to do that just, you know, results in, I think maybe he uses the phrase, it'll make your head explode. It's not really useful to spend a huge amount of time trying to delve back into why, you know, why is this happening? The other aspect of karma, the synchronic, points to the fact that we don't have to be like helpless victims. We are receiving the results of past action, and we have to accept that oftentimes there really is no control over that. These are results that are playing themselves out over a natural law, even if we don't understand it. But right here in the present moment, whatever it is that's arising, we do have the capacity to respond to in an appropriate way. Appropriate meaning a way that doesn't lead to suffering. We have that potential to do that. So that's, you know, it's kind of the blessing of this of that aspect of the teachings of karma, is that we have both the aspects of realizing that there are some things that we can't and don't have to take control of. The workings of the body many of the aspects of the workings of the mental realm, certain feelings and habits of mind are the result of you know, past intentions that are arising as certain patterns of physical experience, situations in our life, and ways that we respond, we don't have to feel like it's our fault. We don't have to throw a guilt trip and say, I should be doing something different. I should have done something better. It's just nature playing itself out from past action, from past intention. But we can actually see it very clearly in the moment, and know that we have the ability to respond in a way that will set the stage for not only future, not only for the future situations that we find ourselves in. You know, we can create good karma that will have good results in the future, but that also, more importantly, we can learn to train the mind to just see it how it is right here and now, and move away from any kind of reaction that's going to increase the difficulty or increase the suffering. That's the potential that we have. So it's neither a strictly deterministic kind of teaching, nor is it a strictly chaotic, you know, there's absolutely nothing we can do kind of a teaching. There's this, both aspects can come into play. So I find that's really useful when, you know, coming up with trying to deal with certain afflictions that come up, and realizing that it doesn't, as Ajahn Pasano was saying earlier this morning, you know, we just don't have a huge amount of control over what this body presents to us. We can tweak it a little bit. We can do things in bits and pieces. We can try our best to take care of it. But you know, essentially it has its own life. It has its own way. It goes according to its own nature. You know, pretty big extent, that's what also happens in the mental realm. The factors of feelings and perceptions, different kinds of thoughts and emotions and habits, and consciousness itself has, to some extent, it has its own momentum, its own life, based on past conditioning. And we can't say that ultimately there is someone who can have control of that, has charge over that. We can, you know, work on developing more skillful ways of experiencing the world. But there's a lot of momentum coming up that we have to be able to observe and see clearly, just as that, just as just the results of past conditions, past activity, manifesting themselves in the way that they would by nature. And realizing at the same time that we can hold that in a way that gives rise to wisdom and understanding, and works towards not creating any further negative karma as a response to what's coming up in our minds at any one time. One of the teachings that I find real useful when confronting difficulties, and you know, it's like I was talking about that when you're looking at certain proliferative thoughts and mind states, that it's useful to go down a layer into a slightly deeper layer of the mind with looking at the kind of underlying feelings and perceptions that are informing and feeding that proliferative process, and using the body as a tool for that, and realizing that, say, from the question of that person with the autoimmune disease, and also any time when you're having intense physical kinds of things, that going down into the level of the body and trying to read the body in the way that certain emotions or mental things are manifesting could be a bit difficult, a bit confusing, because if your body's putting out a whole lot of physically oriented signals just based on physiology, based on, you know, physical disease, then it might be hard to sort of discern the difference between, well, okay, well, what's just a a physical symptom based on this particular illness that I have versus the manifestation of some sort of emotional or mental state. And, you know, is that not in my stomach anxiety, or is that not in my stomach a tumor, you know, or whatever? So I can understand that that would be particularly a challenge. And you know, how to kind of get more of a reading, or how to deal with that, how to hold that, is a real good question. And, you know, perhaps that particular approach isn't always the most useful, particularly if you're dealing with some sort of physically intense kind of an issue. And that's where I find that, for me, reflecting more on the aspects of wisdom teachings, the Dhamma teachings, seeing things through the lens of Dhamma that Lung Pa was talking about this morning, is so useful. And as he was saying, Ajahn Chah used to really emphasize that right from the very get-go, the teachings on anicca, dukkha, and anatta, just bringing those right into the fore of our reflection, of our experience. We don't have to wait until we've got a, you know, purely settled, completely focused, absorbed mind to bring these reflections into our experience. You know, the wonderful simile of the spider sitting at the center of the web and pulling each experience that comes along and gets stuck and wrapping it up in anicca, dukkha, anatta. Just going right to that reflection. And Ajahn Chah expressed it in many different ways. You know, one of the graphic ones that I remember appreciate is that, you know, he would talk. He says, well, anything that comes into the mind, anything that comes into experience, just toss them into the waste bins of anicca, dukkha, anatta. Throw them away into those cans. And it's just developing that kind of habit, training the mind to start seeing things through that lens of Dhamma, and seeing them, you know, starting to consider it, even if we don't have a deep penetration of it, just to start getting the mind around that when possible, is very useful. And then developing the quieting side of meditation practice to help us deepen that to the level of a very deep insight. But that it's, I find that's very useful consideration to bring in to the into the mind, to bring into the experience when confronted with confusing, difficult moments that just seem to defy penetration, defy explanation. And the sutta that, you know, the Buddha taught, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which I think we recited in English earlier, it's in our chanting books. I often find it's just a real useful for reflection, particularly the first part of it. And some years ago, I memorized it just so that I could bring it up in contemplation at times. And I found that over and over again really helpful in these kinds of situations. And, if you remember, it starts out with the phrases of form is not self, or the body. The body is not self. If the body, or if form were self, form, body, would not lead to affliction. And one would be able to say in regards to it, let it be like this, or let it not be like this. In other words, if this body were self, if I had complete charge over it, which is what, you know, the aspect of self would imply, that there's someone who's in charge, that there's a way we can control it, then I certainly wouldn't let affliction happen. I'd be able to say, let it be healthy, let it be good, let me experience only a pleasant feeling in regard to the body. Let there not be this kind of illness, let there not be this kind of difficulty. But, and then the sutta goes on, you know, but since form is not self. Form is therefore subject to affliction. Because it's not self, it is subject to affliction. It's just part of the way it is. We don't have control over it. It will have its difficulties. And one isn't able to say in regard to it, let it be like this, let it not be like this. It's like, I mean, I was just thinking about this in regards to my own body. In the past 6 weeks or so, I've started noticing this kind of little lump in my lower abdomen that starts to appear at different times, and it's basically it's a little hernia that's going on there. And you know, I can sit there and I can look at this lump that I don't think should be there. You know, and I could say to it, "Okay, you know, intestine, you're not supposed to be there. You're supposed to be inside. Go back." You know, I can even push it back a little bit, and it goes back, and then it disobeys me. It doesn't do what I want it to do, and it finds that little weakness in the abdominal wall muscle, and it pokes its head out again, kind of thumbing its nose at me, you know, saying, "Well, I'll show you." And just to watch something that's supposed to be on the inside of the body try and find its way to the outside of the body. Yeah, it hasn't made its way all the way out. But if it had its way, it probably would. So, you know, it's not listening to me. It's not doing what I want it to do. And, you know, maybe I'll have to bite the bullet and do something about it at some point. But, you know, it's just a little thing these little things can be good reminders for us to really take a look, you know, at how much control we have. You know, it's just going the way it's going. It's, you know, following gravity through finding its weak spot to move down. And, you know, I really don't have much control over it. You know, it's sort of like when these little things happen, it's really good to use them as reflections. So when the big things happen, we have a bit more capacity to deal with it. But it's also the same with you know, the mental world, the emotional world. And that's maybe it's a bit harder. It's a little much more of a subjective feeling to it. You know, oftentimes with memories and emotions, there's... You know, it's much more subtle. It's harder to objectify. It's harder to step back because we're so enmeshed with these different kinds of thoughts and emotions as being me, as being who I am. But that's what the power of meditation practice can help with, is kind of developing that ability to step back and say, you know, whoa, you know, that's really interesting. Where did that come from? And maybe over time to just not believe them so much, to step back and say, you know, thoughts, feelings, emotions are not self. If they were self, they would not lead to affliction. And I'd be able to say, let my thoughts, let my emotions, let my feelings be like this, only the good ones. And let them not be like this, the ones I don't want. They go away. But since they are not self, thoughts, feelings, emotions, even consciousness, since they're not self, they therefore lead to affliction. And I can't rightly say of them, let it be like this, let them not be like this. I can choose to know them as they arise. I can choose to know them as they present themselves right here in this moment. And I can watch them go their own way according to nature. I have the ability to pull my attention into the present moment as it happens and not to create any further difficulty around it. That's what I can do. So that's some more of the you know, reflective side, the developing of insight side of things. And, you know, as we've talked about the past 10 days, Ajahn Yatoko talked about the Samatha Vipassana aspects. We go back and forth. We develop both of them as a support for each other. So the more we can develop a still and quiet mind, returning to stillness, returning to that peacefulness, the more clarity we have to be able to develop these insights. And developing that attitude of always being able to, as best we can, pull it back to the present moment and see it in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta, is really the ultimate way we can learn to handle the flow of events in our lives. You know, even when we get caught up in proliferative thinking, maybe we can't use the body. Maybe it's as a device. For reading the mind, if it's confusing, we can always go back to, well, this is confusing, I don't understand it, I'm not sure what it's all about, but I don't have to know every single detail about it. I don't have to know all of its ins and outs, all of its the reasons that it's there, the causes and conditions that led to it, you know, that might make my mind explode. I don't, and again, with that simile of that Ajahn Yatoko used of the arrow, you know, the man who wanted to know all the details of the person who shot it and what it was made of and what the tip was made of, all the aspects of it before anybody pulled it out. Well, we'll die before that happens. So we don't need to know all of the details, but we can start to view it through that lens of transitoriness, through that lens of not who I am, and that it's taking refuge in it is ultimately unsatisfactory. I can't get through a retreat without talking a little bit about body contemplation, the parts of the body, because that's also, I find, there's many different aspects of contemplation of the body that are very useful and for different use for different reasons. But one of the things that I find most useful in terms of helping to get a little bit of a hit around the teachings of anatta are really through, you know, scrupulously investigating the parts of the body. Just to get a sense of this lack of ultimate control, this lack of somebody who has control specifically, say, over the body, but also of the elements of mind. And you can do that. I often give myself a guided meditation around the parts of the body and then subsequently the parts of different aspects of the mind as well. And I find that's very useful. Just, you know, pretend you're giving a guided meditation to some other people, but just doing it for oneself. And, you know, getting quiet and going through and reciting, it's useful to memorize the different parts of the body, or at least some of them that have particular meaning for you, and to really bring them up into active reflection, visualization, getting to know what they look like as, you know, these different organs and constituents that are inside the body, the hair of the head, body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, you know, sinews, bones, all the organs like the heart and the kidneys, just going through them and putting them into the mind very clearly. And after you've kind of done that and gotten some sense of just the actual physical organism, going into a reflection about their nature, particularly in terms of control over them. And, you know, some of them are easier than others to do that with, but like, say, the lungs that are breathing, or the diaphragm that's moving, or in really quiet moments, the heart, the beating of the heart, to really tune into those with the viewpoint of the observer, watching the rising and falling of the actual diaphragm, visualizing what's happening, noticing the expansion of the lungs, the automatic nature of that, and feeling the heart beating on its own accord. And after tuning into that in your self-guided meditation, really just asking yourself, okay, well, who's in control of that? Okay, you know, am I in control of my heart? Okay, I'm gonna tell that heart to stop beating. Heart, stop beating. And it doesn't obey you. Or lungs, stop and try and hold your breath for a period of time. See how long you can do that before it just takes over again on its own accord. So to just watch those with that frame of reference, that do I have any control over this? And if you can do that with a real quiet state of mind, then you start to get a sense of this thing has a nature of its own. It's just following laws of nature. I don't have really any control over it. And the same with the mind, the same with these erratic, erroneous thoughts. You know, just try and force yourself to stop thinking. You know, you might be able to do it for a little while. And then something pops up, some strange thought, whether it's based on, you know, some emotional state or whether it's just a random firing of a neuron. You know, a thought will arise, or a sentence will arise, or this notion will arise, or an emotion will arise. Where did that come from? Do I have any control over that? So just kind of stepping back just a few steps and looking at the nature of these things as they come into being on their own without really any kind of influence or control on your own. You just step back and notice that. They're arising from certain causes and conditions that you maybe don't really know, can't figure out, and don't really have any control of. And just step back and watch the show. And try and hold it with a little bit of lightness as well. You know, sometimes it all seems so heavy and so important and so meaningful and so, you know, so difficult. But stepping back can give a little space around it. You know, treat it with a little tenderness and a little wry regard. I find that very useful. So a lot of what we've talked about, I think, over the past 10 days is kind of run a gamut of both developing, seeing the ways that we kind of tangle ourselves up, the different hindrances, dealing with the different kinds of difficulties that arise, also developing wholesome states of mind, developing skillful ways of being in the conditioned realm, the gladdening of the mind, the softening of the mind, developing useful conditions, but then realizing that they're also still conditions, and then allowing ourselves to gradually quiet with the aid of these wholesome mind states, quiet down, and be able to reflect through this lens of Dhamma, and to be able to, you know, hold those things that are difficult with an appropriate perspective, and also to see the different wholesome states and use those as a way of developing a sense of calm, of peace, that allows us to even see through the lens of Dhamma on a deeper level, to the point where all of the things that we're creating, either through past habits or through present intentions. All of these will arise and cease and pass according to their own nature. And as Lungpa has been talking about, just allowing that to move into a sense of disenchantment with the whole conditioned process, and to be able to relinquish all of these thoughts and notions and ideas and opinions and habits, just turning them over, relinquishing, letting them go, and seeing what seeing what's left. Should be hopefully a bit more peace, a bit more contentment, and eventually taken to its fullest, we have the highest potential of turning that into a very transcendent kind of path of practice for ourselves. So offer that for this afternoon's reflection, leave it there for now.